Welcome to Food for Thought, the place to explore, celebrate, and manifest a life motivated and defined by unconditional compassion and optimal wellness. My name is Colleen Patrick-Gaudreau. I am your host. You can find me at ColleenPatrickGaudreau.com and on Twitter and Instagram and Facebook. And be sure to subscribe to Food for Thought at iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, or wherever you listen to podcasts. If you are enjoying this free podcast called Food for Thought, I ask that you share it with others and leave ratings and reviews. Word of mouth is the best way to increase its listenership, and supporting it is the best way to keep it going. Go to patreon.com/ColleenPatrickGaudreau to leave a tip in the jar. You can go straight to ColleenPatrickGaudreau.com and click on the donate button. Today's topic is laws for animals, effective political activism. Hi, everyone. I hope you're doing fabulously well. I am very excited about today's topic, and it's something we will be focusing on in the, wait for it, second annual Compassion in Action Conference coming up in August 2017. It is all about putting your values to work for animals. If you want to be the best advocate, the best communicator, the best spokesperson for animals, join me and dozens of like-minded people to learn how to be the most effective and powerful ambassador of compassion, how to figure out the best type of advocacy for you. I hear a lot of people ask me that question, how to frame your compassionate values to make a difference for animals, and how to engage politically to change laws that will protect animals in the long term. So register today before the seats fill up at ColleenPatrickGaudreau.com, or just go straight to CompassionInActionConference.com. We are also going to be announcing the next vegan CPG trip to Vietnam at the conference, and attendees get first dibs on signing up. And of course, be sure to check out new episodes of Animology Podcast. But here we are at Food for Thought. Let's get started. I have a question for you. Did you ever watch that show called Inside the Actor's Studio with James Lipton? I used to watch that show all the time. And like everyone else, I always loved the moment at the end of the interview when Lipton would ask the guest the 10 questions. These 10 questions were based on a questionnaire that originated with a French television personality, Bernard Pivot, on his show. And these questions were like, what is your favorite word? What's your least favorite word? What sound or noise do you love? What sound or noise do you hate? What's your favorite curse word? What profession other than your own would you like to attempt? What profession would you not like to do? If heaven exists, what would you like to hear God say when you arrive at the pearly gates? And what turns you on creatively, spiritually, or emotionally? And what turns you off creatively, emotionally, or spiritually? And of course, over the years, when I would watch the show, I would, you know, kind of in my mind answer the questions. What were my answers to those questions? And they would change, you know, what's your favorite word? What's your least favorite word? But one answer to the question, what turns you off, has for me remained steadfast. What turns you off? And for me, that answer has long been cynicism. And I'm not just saying that because the word cynic and cynicism and cynical happens to be an animology. That is, its origins come from an animal. And I'm not kidding. It's a total coincidence. You'll have to listen to Animology Podcast to find out why. I'm saying that because I genuinely think cynicism is one of the ugliest traits in human beings. Cynicism and arrogance. Now, cynicism, of course, is an attitude or state of mind characterized by a general distrust of others' motives. It's a belief that people are generally selfish and dishonest. It goes beyond skepticism. It goes beyond critical thinking. It's just pure cynicism, and I find it really ugly. And one of the places we see cynicism play out most prevalently is in politics, or when we talk about politics and when we talk about politicians. It's become very sexy to be cynical about politics, as if it shows you know what's going on, as if it demonstrates that you've got your finger on the political pulse. Cynicism about politics also seems to serve as a kind of get out of politics free card. That is to say, if you declare that politics is all a sham and politicians are all corrupt, then of course you give yourself permission to be disengaged, to be removed from it. What's the point anyway, right? They're all corrupt, which of course is just an excuse to not get involved. And that works out pretty well. That's pretty convenient. And the truth is, I find that when someone says they're disenchanted with politics and politicians, fed up with the whole political system, I find that these are indeed the folks who are usually on the sidelines rather than in the trenches. I find that the people who are most involved are the least cynical of all. Now, that's not to say that people who are involved in politics in one way or another don't get tired or frustrated with politics. But when you're engaged and you see the system work, you're less inclined to throw the baby out with the bathwater. And so I thought it was time to devote an entire episode to what it means to be politically engaged and how to do so effectively and sustainably. That is, how to be in it for the long haul, both when things feel really urgent and when they're not. And to be really honest, when we're talking about speaking up for the most disenfranchised group who literally has no voice to speak for themselves, animals, it's always urgent. There's no time for complacency. There's no time for cynicism. They need us as their voice, as their ambassadors all the time, because they can't speak for themselves ever. And before I get into the nitty-gritty of how to go about being politically engaged and how to do so effectively, I want to tell you why we need to be politically engaged, or my opinion on why I think we need to be politically engaged. As advocates for causes we care about, whether it's racial justice, environmental issues, animal rights, women's rights, whatever, I know it can be really difficult to decide where to spend your time, where to spend your money, where to spend your energy. And I definitely don't believe there's one answer for each person. I've often said, ask yourself, what do I love? What am I good at? To help you find the answer. But of course, we also have to ask, what type of engagement is the most effective? What will have the most long and lasting impact? Now, that's not to say that you can't be engaged in a number of different types of advocacy, because again, I don't think there's one answer. There's so many ways to advocate for animals. My work, my advocacy, has focused on education and outreach and writing, because I happen to love those aspects of advocacy, because I've honed some skills in those areas, and also because I believe that when we know better, we do better. So I believe that awareness is key to solving problems. And I believe that shifting the way we talk about and think about and behave towards other animals will have long-term impacts in terms of social norms. So that's why I focus on what I focus on. But I also spend my advocacy being politically engaged, because it's not enough to change hearts and minds, which is, again, where I have spent most of my time as an advocate. We also have to change laws. We need laws that protect animals from harm, from abuse, from exploitation, and much more. And who else is better than their advocates to help legislators draft these laws on their behalf? Another reason I think it's important to be involved in the political system is because politics is not separate from who we are as individuals, as citizens. We're all affected. Everyone, all of us, each of us, we're all affected by politics, whether we're engaged or not. The word politics comes from Greek politikos, meaning of citizens, pertaining to public life. We are all public citizens, and we have no right to complain about how politics affects us or animals if we're not actively engaged in making sure the laws reflect the values we care about. To feel down about politics, to be cynical about politics, to be disengaged means to disown your power. Because if you're not talking to the people who represent you and the things you care about, someone else is talking to them about their values and what they care about. Which would you prefer? Would you rather your representatives hear from you and hear about the things that are important to you, like animal protection, like animal rights, like environmental issues, whatever it is? Or would you rather they hear from someone who's going to come along and talk to them about the things that are antithetical to your values? What do you prefer? I could only guess what the answer is. And finally, the other reason I think it's really important to be involved in politics is I personally can't support taking democracy for granted in any way. It's a pretty amazing system. As a human-made endeavor, it's imperfect and it's fragile, just as we are. And yet, it's the best we've got. It's the most successful, long-running experiment we've got as long as we, the people, participate. My husband David often reminds me of that great and famous quote by Winston Churchill: democracy is the worst form of government, except all those other forms that have been tried from time to time. It's been hard fought, it's been hard won, and it's not over. It's a process, and it means nothing if we, the people, don't nurture it. We, the people, because the word democracy is built from the word demos, meaning people. So those are a few of my opinions about why we should be engaged, and I hope that one of them persuades you. And so now let's talk about how to be engaged in the democratic political system, democratic political made up of people system. Now, of course, the way this whole democracy thing works is that we as individual citizens are represented by people we elect to represent us. So when we talk about our representatives, who are we talking about? Well, we're talking about local, state, and federal, right? County also, but mostly local, state, and federal. Right now, at this date and time, there's a lot of focus on the federal government. And I think it's safe to say that there's a pretty engaged citizenry in the United States right now. People are calling and writing to their elected officials, their members of Congress especially, more than, let's say, in the last 8 years. So let's take a look at what it means to be politically engaged. Now, note to listeners, I am a citizen of the United States, and of course, I'm most familiar with our particular type of government. So my language will definitely reflect a U.S.-centric perspective, but I really hope you stick around wherever you are, because I'm certain that you can take what I'm saying and apply it to wherever you live. So we're going to talk about kind of the federal level to start with, and my language is really going to be around members of Congress, but all of what I'm saying applies at the state, county, and local level as well. So when we're talking, first of all, about our members of Congress, number one is know who they are. We need to know who they are. There are a lot of people who don't know who their federal representatives are. It's true. And so when we're talking about who your federal representatives are, of course, we're talking about the House of Representatives and the Senate, right? And so Congress has 535 voting members, 435 representatives, and 100 senators. Each state, 50 states, has two senators. So there's your 100 senators. And the number of members in the House of Representatives is a different story because it's based on population. But you've got 435 representatives and 100 senators. The bottom line is just know who your federal representatives are. They represent you. So you better know who they are and what they stand for. And you can easily find your members of Congress by doing a search online. Of course, I have a link on my website as well. Once you find out who they are, put their numbers in your phone, both their DC office and their district office. Well, what do I mean by that? Well, every representative has a home office. So here in California, of course, my senators are Dianne Feinstein and Kamala Harris. They have an office. They have offices in California, and they also have offices in DC. So you're going to want both their phone numbers and their mailing addresses as well in your address book and in your contact book, whatever it's called these days. Add their email address also to your contacts list. Now, why do you need their contact info? Well, to contact them, right? There are plenty of things to contact our members of Congress about, and you can do so every day if you want. You can pick a different issue every day to write to them about and call them about. You can pick the same issue, or if there's a particular bill that you want to contact them about. But regardless of what you do, I really want to encourage you to not only contact them when you want something done, when you want them to vote yes or no on a bill. I encourage you to also take the time to write or call when they've done something you appreciate. You can only imagine how many negative comments members of Congress get, or any elected representatives get. It's pretty remarkable if you could just imagine how many thousands, how many millions of people they're representing. And how many people contact them when they're unhappy. So your positive comment will definitely stand out. Politics is all about relationships. It's about creating dialogues. Tell them what you care about. Encourage them to support animal-friendly legislation and to oppose legislation that will harm animals. Ask them what their position is on a particular bill or policy. I think a lot of people are intimidated to ask this question, intimidated to call. And if that's the case, then right. But there's nothing to be intimidated about. You have every right to ask them what their position is. And of course, when I say ask them, you're most likely going to be talking to a staffer. So when you pick up the phone to call your representative, you're going to get a staffer. And you can ask them what your representative's position is on a particular issue or on a particular bill. And if they don't know, then ask them to find out and ask them to get back to you. And if they don't, get back to them. And this is what they're there for. They're there to represent you. Now, I shouldn't have to say this, but I will. Be kind when you're talking to a staffer or when you're talking directly to your representative, whether you're writing to them or leaving a message, just be kind. Imagine for a moment being on the receiving end of an angry constituent. As justified as your anger may be, your irascibility will not get you what you want. And especially if you're representing animals, anger is not the way to go. Persistence, clarity, articulateness, passion, all appropriate, as is kindness. Now, when it comes to contacting your members of Congress, of course, people often ask, especially these days when we have so many different ways to contact someone, everyone asks, what's the best way? Now, these are tips from congressional staffers, people who are on the ground. But this, again, applies to whether we're talking about city council members or state representatives or federal. If you are interested in building relationships with members of Congress, I cannot emphasize enough how significant it is to connect with staffers. So we're going to talk more about that in a bit, but here are the most effective ways to get your voice heard. The two best ways are to call or write a letter or postcard, not an email. Buy a book of 34-cent stamps, or hopefully this will probably change at some point, but buy a book of stamps that are appropriate for postcards and buy some postcards. They're really effective ways to get your voice heard and have it counted. And I just find postcards easier than writing a letter, finding an envelope, you know, whatever. I just find postcards really fast and really easy, and they're very effective. So writing a letter, a handwritten letter or postcard, and mailing it, or calling. Those are the two most effective ways to get your voice heard. Leaving a comment on Twitter or Facebook is largely ineffective. So when you write your letter or send your postcard, send it to the district office rather than to DC, or do both, but definitely send your postcard or letter to the district office. When you call, call the district office. You can call the DC office as well, but it's more effective to call your representative at the district office. Emails, virtually ineffective. Staffers will say that they pretty much just group emails using computer algorithms, and then they create form letters based on the topic and position. So emails, they just get too many. It's too overwhelming. It's too much. Your voice doesn't stand out. So emails, virtually ineffective. Phone calls are a different story. Staffers really pay attention when the office gets a number of calls about a particular issue. The district office will often call the DC office to ask if they're hearing about the same issue. And if so, they really take notice. So don't underestimate the power of your letter, of your phone call, and especially if you ask 10 friends to do the same thing about an animal issue, about a bill related to animal issues. There's an article in the New York Times about the level of politically engaged citizenry happening right now. And there was this little gem in the article. It said, there's an adage on Capitol Hill that 5 letters from the district about a bill is cause for alarm, and 10 is a full-blown emergency. That's how little, that's how infrequently members of Congress hear from their constituents. Who are they hearing from? They're hearing mostly from lobbyists. They're hearing mostly from people who are right there in Capitol Hill, but they don't hear from their constituents. I think right now it's a different story because people are really alarmed by what's happening in the White House. So there's a real call to members of Congress to represent what they care about. So I think right now we're in a unique time, but generally that's how infrequently members of Congress hear from their constituents, that when they hear, when they get five letters about a bill, it's cause for alarm, and 10 is a full-blown emergency. That's a low bar. So if you care about something, write your postcard, make your phone call, and tell 10 other people to do the same thing. And that's low. I know you can get more than 10. Now, of course, it's really effective to meet your representative in person. And as their constituent, you have the right to request a meeting, but I won't lie, it's tough to get FaceTime. You can keep trying to do so through their staffers, but one way to connect with them in person would be to go to a town hall meeting. Many members of Congress hold town hall meetings when they return home to their districts from Washington during government recesses. So go to these town hall meetings and don't go alone. Again, bring five other people, 10 other people. Take a group with you of other animal advocates who have a common purpose and maybe have signs specifically around animal issues. Signs that don't say go vegan, just I'm talking about efficacy here. Signs that actually are asking them for something really specific. I don't know. It might be consider animals, you know, or in your legislation or whatever it is, or maybe there's a particular bill. But bring signs, show that there's a coalition there, and ask questions, be heard, make your voice heard. Another way to get your voice heard is if you run an animal advocacy group, invite local staffers to show up at your events. Let them talk to the people you work with. Set up meetings with staffers. Staffers love to get out of the office and meet with constituents and learn about the different issues people care about. Take them out and show them what you care about. Invite them to see what you're working on or what you're concerned about. They take all of that back to the office with them. So what I'm saying is the staffers have a lot of influence, and they're worth spending time cultivating relationships with. Because if the staff knows you, if they have a question about an issue that they know you're an expert in or you've brought to them, they will call you, they will connect with you. So all of this is about cultivating relationships, as I said before. But one-on-one FaceTime directly with your representative, your federal representative, is very difficult. I will tell you this, however, being a donor does help. It's not a guarantee. And in terms of how much you're able to contribute, it's going to be difficult to compete with, say, some of the, you know, PAC money or lobbying money that's coming in. But you are more likely to get FaceTime if you are a contributor, because that it means they expect that you'll be a contributor in the future. Like it or not, donors have more sway. And yes, the higher the contributions, the better the chances are that you and your cause will have a louder voice. Like it or not, that's the way it is. Legislators know they could lose their job because you are the ones who give it to them. So they literally need you to help them keep their jobs. That's all it's about. It's all about, especially when we're talking about members of Congress, or really any elected official, keeping their seat. That's all they care about. And that's where your dollars can have a real impact. Donate to campaigns when it's clear they're animal friendly. Talk to them about the animal unfriendly positions they may have. They might just need information that you can provide. If they stick with animal harmful positions, tell them that's why you're not supporting them. But support them and vote for them when it's clear they're animal friendly, and tell them why you voted for them. Tell them you want to continue helping them make the most compassionate decisions about legislation. Give them and their staffers information about animal issues. I think one mistake animal advocates, and probably other advocates in other arenas, make, one mistake they make, is they just assume that, I don't know, representatives know everything about all the issues we care about. They don't. We're the ones who might have information about things they've never thought about before. So it's up to you to bring it to them. Just support them, talk to them, create a dialogue, create relationships, and give them information. They rely on that. Now, when it comes to contributing to them, of course, you can contribute directly to their campaign, or in general, you can allocate your money to a political action committee or a legislative fund, so you know that your dollars will be going to candidates that support the cause you care about. In this case, we're talking about supporting animal issues, right? So political action committees exist for the purpose of raising and spending money to elect or defeat candidates. They can serve business or labor interests or ideological interests. They can be formed to support or defeat federal candidates or local or specific legislation. The benefit of a political action committee is that money can be pooled together to support, again, to support or defeat candidates or support or defeat legislation. Now, one example for our purposes is the Humane Legislative Fund, which is dedicated to educating elected officials and the public on animal welfare issues and electing humane candidates to public office. This was started by the Humane Society of the United States, and it focuses on candidates running for and in Congress. So more federal campaigns. One helpful resource related to the work of PACs like the Humane Legislative Fund is that they create something called the Humane Scorecard, which helps you decide who to vote for in elections based on their history of animal-friendly or animal-unfriendly legislation. Now, something Wayne Pacelli, he's the CEO of the Humane Society of the United States, said in a talk I saw him give many years ago stuck with me. I have this up on a blog post on my website because I think it's just really helpful to hear. It was really helpful for me. And he has said this many times since about the political arm of the Humane Society, about this Humane Legislative Fund. He said he envisions a National Rifle Association of the animal rights movement. Here's the gist. This is what he said. This is from an interview with Satya magazine many years ago. The way things work in Washington and in state capitals across the country is that logic and humane sensibilities can only go so far. You need them in order to be effective, but you also need to amass political power. And that comes from working the political system in a way that achieves results. There's no substitute for being able to deliver votes and having an informed constituency. I find the NRA's views on hunting, and of course, this is the National Rifle Association he's talking about, I find the NRA's views on hunting and other issues to be really at odds with my own, but I admire the fact that they train thousands of activists around the country to achieve so much working through the system. I do think that's a model for us because we have the potential to activate many more people than the NRA does. There are a lot of people in this country who care about guns, but I think many more people are passionate about protecting animals. If we organize them, we can achieve enormous gains and victories for animals. End quote. As an activist myself and a politically engaged citizen, I couldn't agree more. Unfortunately, I think some people, some progressives don't like this analogy, probably some animal activists, because it's interpreted as giving credence to or even admiration for the NRA. And progressives don't want to look like they're following in the footsteps of an organization they despise. Well, I just don't agree with that. There is no doubt that certain organizations and certain constituencies are much better at organizing. Conservatives are much better at some things than progressives are. They're better at being dedicated to single issues. They're better at being defiant and determined to manifest their ideologies in the political arena. They're better at training future ideologues within their own movement. And they're better at acting at the grassroots level as a coalition. And I think these are all lessons progressives can learn from just because it's coming from a group that you might not agree with. Or in the case of the NRA, the National Rifle Association, just because it's coming from them doesn't mean that there isn't something to learn from. One of the reasons the NRA has been so successful is because they're focused completely on raising money and supporting candidates and pushing through their gun agenda unabashedly and uncompromisingly. I would love to see animal activists take a cue from that, pushing through our compassionate agenda to protect animals from violence unabashedly and uncompromisingly. That's what I would love to see. And one of the ways we can do that is by supporting either, you know, legislative funds, PACs, political action committees, so that we can, in a cohesive way, as a coalition, support candidates who know that they're there because we put them there to further our agenda of compassion. Like, there's nothing wrong with that. There's only good that comes from that. And it takes money to do that. It takes money to support these candidates. It takes money to support their campaigns. So here in Oakland, I, along with fellow dedicated and engaged activists, have formed our own political action committee called East Bay Animal PAC, which is dedicated to electing animal-friendly legislators, passing animal-friendly legislation, opposing anti-animal legislation, and educating legislators and the public on animal issues. You can go to eastbayanimalpack.org and join our mailing list so you can stay abreast of the work we're doing. And most importantly, contribute to our pack. It would be most appreciated. $5, $10, $100, whatever you're able to do goes directly to us working with local officials to enact animal-friendly policies. And of course, one of the things that we're also going to do is, this is relevant for people who live in the San Francisco Bay Area, have a similar scorecard so people can, during election cycles, know who to vote for based on their voting on animal issues. Now, of course, you can consider starting a PAC yourself. Some people create PACs around one particular campaign issue. Some, like ours, are in it for the long haul based on a cause, which in this case is animal rights. But either way, it's an option for you if you're interested in upping your political game for animals, especially at the local level. And that's what we're doing with the East Bay Animal PAC. So little pitch for the East Bay Animal PAC. Go check out eastbayanimalpack.org. And seriously, thank you for supporting it. Every little bit counts. Now, sticking with the local level, as I said at the start, everything I just said applies here. So find out who your representatives are locally, put their contact information in your phone, make connections, meet them in person, work with staffers. At the local level, you are almost guaranteed to connect with your city council member in person or your alderman or your commissioner, whatever they're called in your area. You're almost guaranteed. You can either show up at city hall meetings. You could set up a meeting with them at their office. You could participate in neighborhood events they organize. These are your representatives. They represent you. They work for you. So connect with them. And of course, get to know them. Your city council person is your representative in your district. So they're your neighbors. So I don't know about you, but I like to get to know my neighbors. Get to know your neighbors, including your city council person who represents you in City Hall, and work with them on the issues you care about. At a time when so many people are focused on the national stage, I think it can become a distraction from all of the opportunities and potential to work in the local arena. It doesn't have to be black and white. Of course, you can still engage with your federal representatives, but truly where I know I feel most empowered is when I'm working locally. Now, this is not only because there's real work to be done. There is real work to be done on the local level, real accomplishments to achieve, but also because it's a real opportunity to prime local representatives to be mindful of animal issues. Representatives whose ambitions may be greater than their own backyard. In other words, imagine you being the one to help your local city council person become mindful about all the ways in which animals should be considered when they're drafting legislation. Imagine you help them look through that lens at the local level, and now they're climbing up the political chain of ambition. They may one day be state senator. They may one day be governor. They may one day be a member of Congress. They may one day be president. That's how it works. And helping them look through the lens of animal protection now, while they're accessible, increases the chances that they're going to continue to look through that lens. Also, with your support, you can continue to support them, both with issues and financially, as they pursue their political ambitions. How amazing is that? So I think that's a really good argument for getting engaged on the local level. I think some people think it's just quaint or not effective enough or not as powerful as getting federal legislation passed. And I just think that's wrong for all the reasons I just gave. And what's more, the ripple effects from working on local issues can be huge. Let me tell you a little story about a local city council resolution and the end of an institution that has been hurting and abusing and exploiting animals for over 150 years. But first, a quick thank you to all of you for listening and all of you for supporting this work being the Food for Thought podcast, the Animalogy podcast, the monthly editorials I do for National Public Radio. Another one's coming out very soon. The articles I write. Your support makes all of this possible. Thank you to our platinum supporters, Morgan Hall, David Cabrera, Alexander Gray, Michal Stone, Tim Anderson, Jennifer Ellis and Ben Ellis, Sylvie Raquel, Gwen Mayo, Ulrich, and Renee Marinkovich. And thank you to our newest supporters, Jenna Peoples, April Brown, Megan Lindman, Anita Lago, Sarah Louise, Marie-Eve Bedard, and Dora Bixler. Thank you, everyone. And remember, supporters at $10 and above receive written transcripts to every Food for Thought and every Animalogy episode. So if you're getting anything out of either podcast or my work in general, consider becoming a supporter today. Visit patreon.com/ColleenPatrickGaudreau or just go to ColleenPatrickGaudreau.com. and click on the donate button. You can make a monthly contribution or you can make a one-time donation. Now, you've heard of bullhooks, right? They're the weapons used to hurt elephants, being large, strong, autonomous beings, to make them move and perform in ways they would never do naturally, because performing tricks for humans is perverted and against everything that makes sense for elephants. So of course, in order to make them do what you want, you have to hurt them. And bullhooks are used to intimidate and hurt them. So activists in Los Angeles, and I have to give major kudos to the amazing, dedicated, and tireless activist Sherry Shankar in Los Angeles. Activists like Sherry in Los Angeles worked with city council members to draft legislation to make the bullhook illegal in the city of Los Angeles. Now, some animal advocates railed against this because it was just targeting one animal welfare issue rather than putting forth legislation to ban circuses altogether. But it was a brilliant maneuver because of what happened next. LA City Council voted for the ban, despite Feld Entertainment. Feld Entertainment's the owner of Ringling Brothers Circus. Despite Feld putting a ton of money and resources into fighting this ban, they knew it was a slippery slope and they were afraid of exactly what happened next. Oakland activists worked with city council members to put forth our own legislation to ban the bullhook here in Oakland based on what had been done successfully in Los Angeles. Feld Entertainment descended again, came to Oakland, used it as a wedge issue to pit union workers against animal advocates, and they fought the ban. The ban passed the Oakland City Council. Despite their resources they poured into fighting this ban, the Oakland City Council passed the bullhook ban. And so bullhooks themselves were going to soon be illegal in the city of Oakland. And that's when Feld Entertainment, Ringling Brothers, realized they were going to have to fight this type of legislation in city after city after city, as more cities started drafting their own legislation modeled after the work of LA and Oakland activists. And they knew that without being able to hurt and intimidate elephants with this weapon, they wouldn't be able to make them do perverse tricks. So you know what they did? They said, well, we're taking elephants out of our shows because, you know, no bullhook, no elephants. It was a major, major victory. But again, some animal advocates saw the fact that other wild animals were still being harmed and hurt and abused and exploited in circuses, which is absolutely true. And they criticized activists for not putting the efforts into banning circuses entirely, because now you had only elephants removed and not all the other animals who are abused for such entertainment. However, the slippery slope had already begun. And less than a year later, I feel like it was 6 months, even less than that later, Feld Entertainment announced they're closing down Ringling Brothers Traveling Circus altogether. Like closing down because of declining sales, because of a public that had grown disgusted by making captive, tortured wild animals perform, and because of these city-by-city bans. Closing. You've heard the news. You've heard the news. It's significant. Now, listen, did years of protests and leafleting by activists outside of circuses contribute to their downfall? Absolutely. Did undercover footage obtained by amazing activists and organizations proving with video evidence the abuse that took place behind the scenes, did that help? Absolutely. Did education and outreach help? Absolutely. Did litigation, all the lawsuits against Ringling all these years, did that help? Absolutely. All of this contributed to the demise of Ringling. But in the end, it was the decisions of local city councils and the activists living in those cities that led to the closing of a 150-year-old animal abusing institution. That's the power of local political action. And I just have to say this. I have to say this because I mentioned this when I talked about the bullhook ban in another episode. I think I had just given the update in the story and I had read my comments to the, comments that I had read to the city council that night. But it is significant. I love that Oakland was part of this story because Jack London, writer, author, and resident at some point of Oakland and going Berkeley, he is a beloved son of Oakland. We have Jack London Square. Jack London is a huge presence here in this city. And in the early 1900s, he had become so disgusted by what he found out about performing animals and the abuse they were subjected to, that he appealed to the public and said, listen, we need to stop this. You need to write letters to the editor. You need to write letters to management and tell them this is not acceptable. And you need to go to the circuses and then do formal walkouts to protest these circuses. And you know what? People started doing that and started these Jack London clubs. Now, unfortunately, Jack London died before he saw the effects of these clubs. And the effect of these clubs, we're talking about a million people had formed these clubs or part of these clubs, writing letters to the editor, writing letters to management, going to circuses and doing walkouts. And you know what happened? Ringling Brothers actually removed animals from their circuses and said that they were going to be removing them for good. Now, unfortunately, during the Depression, it became a cheap way to provide entertainment for people and animals were brought back. But for 5 years, because of the appeal that Jack London had made to the public and because of the activists that had worked at his behest, animals were removed from the circus. And I think that's just really significant. So I just love that that's part of this story. And it's 100 years later. I wish it came earlier, but here we are and the time has come. And this is one of the things, by the way, that we're going to be doing in the Compassion in Action Conference on Sunday. I'm actually going to be taking those who are interested. People have to RSVP for it. Only those who are coming to the event can join me on Sunday. I'm going to be doing a walking tour of animal protection history in Oakland. So if you do come, sign up for our event in August. I hope you join us on Sunday. You're welcome to. It's part of the registration fee to come with me and celebrate all of the animal protection history here in Oakland in particular, and of course in the San Francisco Bay Area. Now, there's more work to do, of course, around this issue. Cities such as San Francisco and others around the country have already banned wild animal acts from the city. And actually, while I was recording this, I literally got an email from the Humane Society, and I know the activists who are working on this, is breaking news, Los Angeles to ban use of all wild animals in circuses. I'm reading this just as I'm seeing it for the first time myself. The city council of the nation's second largest city and the capital of the entertainment industry today unanimously voted to ban the exhibition of wild or exotic animals for entertainment, including circuses, other wild animal shows, displays in public areas such as on sidewalks and parks, and rentals for house parties or events. This just happened just now as I was recording this episode. I'm not kidding. And other cities have already passed these bans, as I said, San Francisco, counties in Idaho, counties in New Jersey, Massachusetts, North Carolina. But Los Angeles is by far the largest jurisdiction to enact such a ban. And there's already a conversation that's happening right now with the Oakland City Council. There have been activists who have been working on this. We've had meetings with our city council members. And I believe that four are already on board, and we already have people who are on the city council to draft this legislation to ban wild animal acts in Oakland. And this is something that activists all around the country could be working on in their own cities, in their own counties, wherever you feel that you have relationships you can start cultivating. This is the perfect opportunity to make sure that the void that Ringling is leaving won't be filled by other animal-based circuses. So that's why we have to do bans like the one that just is going to pass in Los Angeles, because just because Ringling closed doesn't mean it's going to close forever. As I said, animals were brought back, even though Ringling had promised to not bring them back. After 5 years, they brought them back. So there's always a chance they could come back and other circuses could crop up and fill in that void. So there's such an opportunity to ride on the momentum of the demise of Ringling. So contact the organizers of the bands in Los Angeles, in Oakland, and work on this in your own area. So this is an example of how just momentum and dedication on behalf of activists and working with city council members led to Ringling Brothers closing its doors. There are so many ways to get involved politically and make a huge difference. Our voices and our votes for animals are needed all the time, not just when we're in crisis. We need to act now. We need to organize now. We need to be a resounding voice for animals now. I recoil from the phrase now more than ever because our voices and votes for animals are needed all the time, not just, as I said, when we're in a crisis. But I do think we're eager, we're anxious, we're desperate to have our voices heard on behalf of animals now more than ever. So let's do it. Work with our democratically elected officials to consider the fate, the lives, and the plight of other animals when passing laws and resolutions. We can do this together. As hopeless as you may feel sometimes, I'm here to tell you there is much work to be done and work that is waiting for you to do it. One of my favorite takeaways from the book Hope in the Dark by Rebecca Solnit, it's a book I read right after the election, is that when we think of the darkness before us, when we contemplate that, what I love is that she's reframed the darkness not to be inevitable evil, but rather the darkness means that the future is inscrutable because it's not yet written. It's up to us to write the future. So that darkness is just a blank slate waiting for us to create what the future is. And I love that. The future is not yet written, so go write the future for the animals. This is Colleen Patrick-Gaudreau. Thanks for listening.